your time at ASIJ, 1980s. Now you've back on campus, you know, 2020s. What would you say has stayed alive in regard to that ASIJ culture for the past 40 years?
Again, I think the sense of community, that is huge, because even to this day, my closest friends are probably the friends that I made at ASIJ, which, you know, is kind of crazy. even kids that, you know, moved away after elementary school, I'm still very close with. And, you know, every chance I get, if I'm near where they live or vice versa, we always get together. And especially with social media these days, you can, you know, connect with anyone around the world. And that's easier now. Like, there's still the cycling of kids that come through international schools and are there for 3 years and then move on to the next country. But it's a lot easier to keep in touch now, you know. But I think these connections that they make at ASIJ and at international schools, there's some sort of a bond that is definitely a lasting bond. And even people who did not go to my school, if I find out that they have gone to other international schools and you meet as adults, there's this sort of, and this close connection that you feel very comfortable. You can relate on a much deeper level than other people who have not gone through this international school system. So.
Welcome to the 73rd episode of Tokyo Alumni Podcast. Today, our guest is the director of the Tokyo Cancer Clinic in Japan. She attended ASIJ from 1976 to 1988. Upon graduating high school, she attended UC Berkeley for a bachelor's degree and then went on to earn her Doctor of Medicine at SUNY Stony Brook. She has practiced emergency medicine in New York and New Jersey for over 15 years. And in 2014, she and her family moved to Tokyo to help with her father's cancer immunotherapy clinic. Having lived outside of Japan for 26 years, she experienced a bit of culture shock, having to relearn Japanese and understand a completely different medical system. Her passion project is to help cancer patients navigate the Japanese medical system while coaching them to thrive and not just survive with lifestyle medicine and mindset. Welcome to the podcast, Minako.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, thank you for joining us. It's not up yet, but actually it's two doctors in a row. So it's this is a season of doctors so far, it seems like. So I know I just did a quick intro, but maybe in your own words, if you could just tell us very quickly, you know, what you do and who you are.
Mm-hmm. So this was kind of a long meandering journey to get here. But what I do now is I run the Tokyo Cancer Clinic, which is a private immunotherapy clinic. You know, if you think about it, we all have cancer cells in our body, whether or not they're sort of precancerous cells or cancer cells, you know, just because we're exposed to, you know, lots of things that cause mutations and just our cells in general, as they replicate, they, you know, make mistakes. But the difference between people who actually do get full-blown cancer and people who stay cancer-free is really our immune system. So what our cancer does, you know, in simplistic terms, is help our immune system to try and, you know, do what it's trained to do, what it normally does to help fight off cancer. So we take the immune cells that are within our bodies, you know, from a blood draw, extract the immune cells and grow them out to great numbers, return them back into our bodies. And we also create cancer vaccines from our immune cells. So it's pretty interesting, cutting edge stuff that isn't really available in the United States and in Europe. So it's been really interesting part of my journey. So that's what I do now.
Wow. That's and you mentioned in your bio how you started as a doctor in the States. I guess we'll get right into it. I think a big thing for international school students is like, where am I going to work at? And I know in the areas of like law and like things like doctors, it's very country specific, right? There's a lot of people become lawyers in the States and it's like, how do I get back to Japan? You know, that's a whole nother episode, I think, but it's a very niche way, right? It's a very small market.
But
for doctors, how common is it for people who are you know, earn their MDs in the States to start working in Japan.
Right. It's really, really a tough road. After I went to ASIJ, when I graduated, I moved to the United States. I went to UC Berkeley, same as you.
Yes.
And yeah, you know, and it was great. And I wasn't sure that I was going to be a doctor right away. You know, I sort of studied art history and, you know, psychology, and didn't think that I was going to be a doctor, but I actually did sort of at ASIJ, I thought I wanted to be a doctor. And then, you know, you move to the States and you're a little, you go from being a big fish in a tiny pond to a little fish in a big wide ocean. And then, you know, you sort of go through this period of rediscovery and like, what do I really want to do? What do I want to be? So it took me a while to come back full circle to decide to want to become a physician again. I eventually did make that realization, which was great. And I didn't plan on coming back to Japan, in all honesty. I really thought that, you know, I was going to stay in the US, and I became an ER doctor, which I loved. It was like, you know, it was exciting every day. You see something new. You get to treat people from all walks of life, from, you know, the moment they're born to, unfortunately, when they die. Regardless if they're a homeless person, you know, off the cities of New York City, or if they're a millionaire or a celebrity, you know, you treat them all the same. And so I really love that work. But I think after a while practicing, I started realizing that about 80% of what came through those doors were caused by poor lifestyle choices, you know, whether it was drugs or alcohol or, you know, even infectious diseases, even cancer, like 30 to 50% of cancers can actually be prevented with lifestyle. So then I started getting really interested in lifestyle medicine. And then from there, you know, my father, who runs the Tokyo Cancer Clinic, has been asking me to come back to help him because he's 82 now. And so we decided to make the leap to Japan. I know I got a little off track there, you know, and how hard is it, you know, to go from being a doctor in the US to Japan? And it is really, really a long road. So I had to start relearning my Japanese. Now, 26 years later, I hadn't used my Japanese at all. And again, going through international school, you know, you don't master the language, especially if you're not studying it in school, which I was studying French for some reason. So, yeah, relearning. It took a good maybe 3 years of being back in Japan to relearn the language. And I took all the language tests, the JLPT tests, in order to sit for the Japanese boards.
Yeah, so, you read my mind with the JLPT. Is that, is your nationality, like your passport, not Japanese? Is that why you would have to take JLPT, or do you have to take it even then?
Even if you have the Japanese nationality, if your education was in English, and yeah, you didn't go to Japanese high school or college, then you actually have to take the JLPT.
Interesting. Okay, that's actually really good to know.
So, you know, I went through all that, and then I got, you have to get all your documents translated and everything, and I took it to the ministry, and they said, well, okay, you have to take an oral board. Medical boards and a written medical boards, you know, which I was fully prepared to do. And then they said, well, and then we have a new rule that you also have to do 2 years of residency.
Oh, in Japan.
Yeah. So, you know, at that point, you know, I'm already, you know, trying to manage the clinic and working in the clinic, and not as a doctor, but more as run the clinic. And, you know, I can't, unfortunately, take 2 years off to do a residency elsewhere and then come back. Yeah. So at that point, I decided that I wasn't going to pursue my medical license here. So, you know, what I do here is I run, because we do such specialized work in working with the immune system, we have a laboratory that does regenerative medicine. So to grow the cells and to create the cancer vaccine. So I've been focusing my efforts on research and doing managing the lab. Of course, I miss seeing patients and talking to patients and helping them. So And I became really interested in lifestyle medicine. So I actually boarded, and there's a new medicine board actually of emergency of lifestyle medicine. So I actually boarded in lifestyle medicine, and we do a lot of coaching. So because everybody pretty much knows what to do, but it's really hard to follow the instructions on, you know, on what, you know, you're supposed to eat well and sleep well and decrease your stress and exercise and all that. And these things all have evidence behind them to reduce cancer recurrence. You know, but part of it is getting people motivated to actually implement those changes. So then I started doing health coaching. So that's a service that we also offer our cancer patients. That way I can sort of still see patients in a clinical setting without actually practicing and having a medical license here.
So you mentioned, you know, things like getting enough sleep, obviously like eating nutritiously. Are there any sort of myths when it comes to, oh, you know, that might give you cancer? Like one I've always heard of is I'm a consumer of a Diet Coke.
Okay. And
it has that, you know, that substance that's not quite sugar, but it sort of emulates sugar.
Yeah.
And I'd say in my lifetime, at least probably 50 people have told me, oh, that gives you cancer. So is that a myth, or is there a point to sort of that artificial substance?
There have been studies, usually mostly rat studies and mouse studies, that if you do give them a lot of like aspartame or some of the sugar replacements, there have been links to cancer with that. I'm sorry to tell you, but most of the studies, they're done with really massive amounts. So, you know, how that translates to humans and human studies, you know, smaller amounts. I think, you know, epidemiologically, I think if you look at it in the big picture, you know, you can say, you know, why is it that one person who smokes chain smokes all their lives never get cancer, and then another person who's never touched a cigarette in their life does? You know, you can't necessarily say one-on-one that there's a correlation, but if you take, you know, a huge population and say, okay, well, you know, this chunk of people, they smoke cigarettes, are they more likely to get cancer than not, than non-smokers? Then yes, absolutely. There is a huge, you know, out of the population that smokes, they are way more likely to get cancer. So, you know, it's not 100%, but, you know, with the best of our knowledge, you know, people who do consume some of the artificial sugars, they do, they might have a propensity to getting cancer.
Are there any other things like that come up, like that Coke question I just had, where people are like, does this give you cancer?
Yeah, for sure. And that's like one of the biggest things for, especially for cancer patients. They're always wondering like, well, what can I eat? Am I supposed to eat? Do I have to avoid all sugars? And so that's another big one, like regular sugar, right? They say, because if you go to the doctor and you get a PET scan, which is a type of CAT scan, and the areas that have higher metabolism light up, right? What a PET scan is basically a sugar metabolism scan. So what they do is they make sugar molecules radioactive, and then they inject it into your body, and then you do the CAT scan. So areas that light up, they say, okay, well, that's suspicious of cancer, because that's where the cells are eating up all the sugars. So logically, you're like, okay, well, that means sugar must be bad, because sugar must be feeding my cancer. Right. So there are a lot of people who like go on a keto diet, for example. And there are some studies that say in some cases, having a keto diet helps them. But again, everything's not so simple. When you look at the big epidemiologic studies, they said that, you know, avoiding sugars altogether, it doesn't improve your chances of a cancer getting worse or having a cancer recurrence. But I think the takeaway or the logical way to think about it is that obviously you don't want to do too much of anything, right? Because the more sugar you take in, the higher your insulin levels rise, and insulin is actually a growth factor. So you don't want your insulin turned on all the time. The more sensible approach to take is not to sort of go to extremes and say, I'm never going to eat this, or I'm never going to do this, because, you know, doing it once doesn't mean that you're going to get it. And completely avoiding it doesn't mean that you're not. But I think the healthier way to think about it is say, you know, it's best to eat real whole foods that have a lot of polyphenols in it and antioxidants in it, and not eat too much of one artificial thing, because that's just going to trigger your growth factors and potentially, you know, worsen your prognosis for cancer. But again, your body has different ways of assimilating all of this. So it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, one thing's better than another. Just
when it comes to things like family history, how much of, I guess, you know, the old question of sort of nature versus nurture.
Yeah.
So I remember, you know, when I had testicular cancer, that was, you know, the first thing I kind of looked at, well, what did, you know, my parents or grandparents. So is there sort of an element, I know there's disease like Graves' disease, that's like what, 50% genetic, but when it comes to cancer, how much of a role does that, does genetics play?
There are certain cancer genes that run in families. And when you have them or when you get them from your parents, definitely your chances are higher. Okay. And I say it's higher, like 60%, 70% higher than a regular person, but it's not zero, you know? And I think the difference between it is, again, how we live, you know, and you could do all the things right and still get cancer, right? Obviously it's not your fault. You know, I think you have these genes and then you have these on and off switches on your genes. It's something called epigenetics. And what determines whether or not certain genes are expressed or not expressed has a lot to do with your lifestyle, and it has to do with stress. I mean, something as esoteric as stress can actually turn on or off certain genes. So even things like Alzheimer's very strongly can run in your family if you have a gene called APOE4. And if you have two copies of them, then, you know, you have a very, very high risk of getting Alzheimer's, like 60 to 70% chance. But at the same time, you know, it means that 30% of them are not getting Alzheimer's. So, you know, what's the difference, you know? And what they're finding more and more is people who exercise a lot, you know, who eat very healthy and who eat well, who sleep enough. You know, getting 7 to 8 hours of sleep is actually key, especially for Alzheimer's and also for cancer, because that's when your immune system is repairing your body, decreasing stress levels as much as you can. That really has a big connection as to what genes get turned on and what genes get turned off.
So you mentioned sleep, and I wonder if you have similar observations as I have. I feel like people in Japan really don't sleep. Has that been your experience so far?
Since COVID hit, people are getting more sleep, and that might be one of the only positives out of the pandemic. But sleep is huge. And especially in Japan, people don't get enough sleep. You know, sleep is super important. You can live without food for a month, right? You can survive without food for a month. You can only survive without sleep for 2 weeks. Everybody dies, basically, you know? Yeah, and they've done, you know, horrible, again, poor rats, right? Experiments. And they also cannot live more than 2 weeks. And part of the reason is, you know, so much, we spend a third of our lives asleep, if you think about it, or we're supposed to anyway. And the less sleep that you get, the less chance our body has to heal itself and repair itself. And also the immune system, that's when it fully works, right? So that's when your body, you know, your immune cells are patrolling your body. If it finds any abnormal cells or early cancer cells, that's when it gets rid of it. So the less you sleep, the more chance you have of getting cancer. And actually the World Health Organization at some point even said that if you do shift work, like nighttime work versus daytime work, that is considered a carcinogen, because you actually have, you know, when your circadian rhythms are flipped around and also you don't get enough sleep, you actually do have a higher risk of getting cancer.
Interesting. So let's talk a little bit about you personally. So, you know, you, you were in the States for a while, and I think not many of us have sort of the experience you have where you really lived in Japan for a long time, in the US for a long time.
Right.
Came back, I think after 26 years, almost 30 years, what was the reverse culture shock like? And the reason why that came to my mind was because we were talking about sleep. And that was definitely, I was only gone for 4 years for college when I came back here. Obviously I'm gone again now, but that was one thing that just blew my mind is my colleagues were all sleeping 5 hours. And I was like, sorry guys, I'm not built like that. You know, I will just like sleep. I'll come to work late if I have to. So anyways, enough about me. So for you, what were some of the biggest things, you know, that you would, if you could go back, you wish you were mentally prepared for?
The commute, the train culture, right? I'd pretty much forgotten about that, being squished like a sardine and, you know, not having that personal space. That was a big one. I think also, I felt like in the States, I was very used to people speaking their mind, I think. And I felt that when I came back here, it's like you are constantly having to sort of read between the lines because everything is said in a very kind of indirect roundabout way. And you kind of have to figure out, oh, well, they're saying this, but they actually mean this, you know? And I think it took me a long time to get the nuances. And then also, like, I left when I was 18, you know, and when I came back, you know, as an adult and as a professional, it's very different because it just, the language is different, first of all, right? Mm-hmm. I left speaking kid Japanese and I had to come back speaking, you know, proper, you know, business Japanese, which was difficult, I think. And then I guess, yeah, most of that, the nuance. And also just sort of being a female in the workplace, I think was different. No one like expected me to serve them tea or anything, but I'm sure, you know, for people who work more in an office center setting, that might be very different. Also, if people talk about the way you look, the way you dress, your body shape, you know, how big you are, how little you are, you know, and I think when I came back, I was probably about maybe a good 20 or 30 pounds heavier. And people were just fine about talking about your weight to you, you know? And that was a bit of a shock to me.
Yeah. And when you came here, your kids were still quite young. So how did they adjust to sort of returning or not really returning, but, you know, going to a sort of a new home?
I think it was a good fit for them, right? Their dad is American. And obviously I'm Japanese. But where we were living at the time in New Jersey, there were very, very few Asians in our town. And, you know, they were little enough that they didn't notice or that they were treated differently or anything. But I think as they got older, they probably would have started to notice, you know, maybe they were sort of treated differently. And when we moved here, it was very intentional to be moving back so that they could attend ASIJ as well. Yeah, and one of the deciding factors is we were here for a visit and it happened to be Spirit Day at ASIJ. And so I was there with my husband and, you know, it's such a different culture, just the international school culture, you know, and there were high school students that were like walking arm in arm, like hugging their parents. And, you know, the older kids were helping out the younger kids. And my husband kind of looked at me and said, you know, what is this like strange world? It's like, you know, traveling back in time to the 1950s and everybody's like very family oriented and happy and helping each other. And they're like, teenagers in America are not like this. And so I kind of looked at him and said, yeah, I know, you know, our kids are going to come here. And so that was really a big deciding point. So going back to how it was for them, I think it was a very good fit. You know, they right now, at ASIJ, you know, there's a good percentage of the kids who look like them, you know, and I think it's kind of a comfort and, you know, they didn't have to deal with, again, the, you know, who am I, what am I, you know, this sort of identity thing. I mean, all kids go through it, obviously, but at least in terms of culture and race, that's like one aspect that they didn't have to deal with.
Interesting. Yeah. Cause I feel like, you know, that's another common theme, especially with the older alums is where do you live in regards to, you know, your child's or your children's education and, you know, how they will adapt or the difficulties they have. And definitely ASIJ does help because it does, as you said, sort of, even if you are straddling cultures, as a school, it is already kind of straddling cultures as an institution. So it makes that transition, I think, very easy in comparison to people, you know, go to the US public schools or Japanese public schools. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as a parent, how has your perspective evolved or, you know, changed of how you view ASIJ in comparison to, you know, how you used to look at ASIJ as a student or as an alum before sending mm-hmm. your kids there?
Yeah, I think it has definitely changed a little bit, you know, in some ways for the better. In some ways, you know, I think they're trying to teach kids so that they are well-rounded, you know, which is great, sort of global learners, lifelong learners, which I think is all really great and important. I do feel like maybe kids feel this very heavy responsibility and weight also due to that, because they feel like they have to achieve so much and become accomplished. I don't know. I think there maybe is a lot of pressure that they're supposed to, you know, go on and be great and do great things. And for some kids, I think that's kind of a big heavy weight on their shoulders. So I guess there are pluses and minuses to that sort of approach.
Yeah, I definitely see that trend too. And I mean, I was in high school not that long, 16 years ago. And there's mm-hmm. definitely, even between myself and the current high schoolers, it seems like things like the SAT, for example, mm-hmm. you know, it's always around, but, you know, we just sort of practiced it on our own. There were camps and mm-hmm. stuff, but now it's like, seems like it's the norm is to, you know, go to prep school and
right
outside of
ASIJ. There's a lot of pressure, yeah, to perform really well and to get into really great college and all that. And I feel like when I was going through it, we're kind of clueless to that. you know, obviously there was a little bit of a focus on it, but I felt like we could just grow up and just be kids and just enjoy life. Yeah, so I feel like maybe there's, in today's world, you know, kids are feeling maybe a little bit more pressure in that manner.
I agree. I definitely see that myself. When, obviously it's a little bit farther forward, but eventually then your children will have to, you know, decide where their next step is going to be. As a parent, you know, I feel like with ASIJ, you know, the world is your oyster, right? Like you just, it could be Canada, UK, US, mm-hmm. Japan. Do you guys have any thoughts? I know it's a good five, six years mm-hmm. away until your oldest mm-hmm. goes into college, but have you guys started to look into, you know, the advantages and disadvantages of going into different countries?
Both of my kids probably would want to go to college in the US, you know, just because that's, you know, the other sort of half of their identity. And because all of their education has been in English, I think Japan's offering more and more, you know, in terms of English track, you know, universities here. So I think that's a great option. Even in medicine, actually, there's one school now in Chiba that you can go directly from high school, and it's like a 6-year medical school program where wow. you end up getting licensed in Japanese. And the first 2 years are actually in English, and they actually do accept kids. I think there's been a couple of kids from ASIJ who've gone there now. So this is something that's, yeah, really brand new. Usually it's only in like international relations or non-STEM subjects that you could attend, like the ICU, Waseda, Sophia, you know, those international programs. So yeah, things are changing. Yeah,
that's really cool. I know for law, Hitotsubashi now has something too for like kind mm-hmm. of what would be the sort of equivalent of a law school in the States. So yeah, that's really cool. There's these new options that didn't exist, mm-hmm. you know, just 10 years ago. So your time at ASIJ, 1980s, mm-hmm. now you're back on campus, you know, 2020s. 2020s. And what would you say has stayed alive in regard to that ASIJ culture for the past 40 years?
Again, I think the sense of community, that is huge, because even to this day, my closest friends are probably the friends that I made at ASIJ. Mm-hmm. which, you know, is kind of crazy. even kids that, you know, moved away after elementary school, I'm still very close with. And, you know, every chance I get, if I'm near where they live or vice versa, we always get together. And especially with social media these days, you can, you know, connect with anyone around the world. And that's easier now. Like, there's still the cycling of kids that come through international schools and are there for 3 years and then they move on to the next country. But it's a lot easier to keep in touch now, you know. But I think these connections that they make at ASIJ and at international schools, there's some sort of a bond that is definitely a lasting bond. And even people who did not go to my school, if I find out that they have gone to other international schools and you meet as adults, there's this sort of, and this close connection that you feel very comfortable. You can relate on a much deeper level than other people who have not gone through this international school system. So I think that's really fascinating. And I think that that is something that's definitely lasted, and that my kids, their friends from this time at ASIJ will be lifelong friendships as well.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean with sort of the, you meet someone else who, you know, went to St. Mary's, Seisen, all those schools. And it's like, you're already, you know them. even if they're like, you know, a bit older or younger than you, it's like they went through the same system. It's like you can relate so many levels, which is really, really cool. But yeah, this takes us to the end of the podcast. So I like to finish asking the guests, you know, what's coming up in their life for the next few years, next few decades. So what is on the horizon, Miyako?
Okay. I guess the one thing ASIJ did instill me is the whole lifelong learning bit. You know, I'm constantly learning more, changing. I have been really blessed in the last year to, you know, meet so many people, especially the expat community in Tokyo, international school grads and things like that. And I feel like, again, they're my people, they're my community. And so I'd like to reach out and be more active within our community and help them in terms of, you know, achieving their best health, being here for them as a clinic if they need it, and just trying to spread the word in terms of, you know, there's so much that's within our power that we can do to, you know, help us help ourselves with our health through lifestyle measures. So that's something that I'd like to continue spreading.
Awesome. Yeah, it's really cool stuff you do. And Tokyo Cancer Clinic, where are you guys located again?
We're in Kudanshita, actually in Iidabashi, between Iidabashi and Kudanshita in Tokyo.
All right. So yeah, right in the center-ish part of Tokyo.
Yeah.
Born in Iidabashi.
Near the Budokan.
Yeah, near the Budokan. So that's really cool. You're going to be right there for any grads who are in Tokyo. Well, again, thank you for being on this podcast. And hopefully I'll see you in person one day. I'm in Tokyo now and then. So
that would be awesome.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much.